Accession number 19990, reel 22.
Chief Technician Roper, reel 22. You were saying you spent your leave visiting relatives, and I think you were looking for somewhere to
live. My wife and family had never been in the north of England, in Yorkshire. And so I knew Yorkshire, having spent the war years in this area and having relatives in Lincoln and Leeds and Harrogate, sort of going round and renewing sort of old acquaintances and showing my family the area, which they liked. But anyway, I moved up to Accrington on my own, and it was a small helicopter flight, two Whirlwinds, and it was shift work. I was one of the shift bosses, but we had a flight sergeant in charge, overall charge, and the lads there soon sort of showed me how they operated, which was slightly different to previous operation of Whirlwind, insofar as corrosion and salt spray from the work they did had to be treated instantly, whereas and engines were constantly washed to keep the salt corrosion down. So I quickly got into the routine, and
was it first line servicing you were doing?
First line. And of course, the Air Force was becoming top heavy. So where you would have normally had, say, a chief tech and maybe one sergeant and two corporals and a junior technician on the shift, we tended to have three chief techs and a sergeant. And so there was an abundance of experience that made light work of the problems that arose, but it wasn't very satisfying for a senior NCO to be filling the boots of a junior technician or a corporal. This later, when I moved back to Leconfield, the headquarters staff that were the second line servicing ASF, if you like, they were manned more or less to their establishment. In other words, they only had four chief techs in the whole of the hangar to do the servicing, so many sergeants, so many corporals, airmen and so on. And in order to achieve this, they tended to post the chief techs that they no longer wanted or didn't fit to the flights, which in my case, we ended up with 13 chief techs on a flight. Fortunately, I was the senior one, but it's always difficult to deal, if there are sort of personal problems, to deal with a man of your own rank and sort of have to give him a dressing down. It did cause serious problems, but that's another story.
Are you saying then that seniority really wasn't enough to give you the authority you needed?
Well, I mean, I most of my chief techs, because I respected them for what they were and what they'd done, and that I didn't talk down to them, if you like. When I was first interviewed for the subsequent posting, I was posted back to Leconfield within 3 months of going to Accrington, because there was a vacancy for an NCO to run the helicopter flight, which was an identical unit to that which I was leaving at Accrington, but was at Leconfield, which happened to have the headquarters unit there as well. But on this particular flight, they had a rather strong-willed Scottish chief tech, who, when the NCO in charge was posted, thought that he would, having been second IC, would take over the unit. And the powers that be didn't want this particular senior NCO in charge. And so what they did, they looked around and found that I was more senior than this particular gentleman. So I was brought down to take over at Leconfield. And not many people at Leconfield knew who I was, apart from the Scottish chief technician who was expecting to be the IC. He had taken over from me in the engine bay at Changi when I left Changi, so I'd met him before and we'd got on quite well then, as he ran himself into my shoes there. So when I came down to posted back to headquarters at Leconfield, I was taken in for an interview by a flight lieutenant navigator who was the CO of the flight. And I remember it was quite an interview. The first thing he said when he looked at me, he said, "Well, I haven't taken an instant dislike to you, Chief." And I thought, well, what sort of an interview is this? And he asked me a number of questions and he said, what do you think is going to be your hardest problem here? And I told him that the fact that the flight was over its establishment on senior NCOs, I said, well, I think the biggest problem is going to be preventing the senior NCOs sort of getting into trouble with the air crew that are snagging aircraft, because you always get, there's one pilot, they have a bad back, and every time they bring the aircraft back, they say it's got this wrong or that wrong, and change the pilot, change the snag. And we often used to get this. I mean, certain pilots will take an aircraft, bring it back every day for a month, never a problem. Another pilot, he takes an aircraft and brings it back every day, and it's got bigger and bigger problems every day. And you start to sort of think there's something amiss with the pilot, rather. And, of course, this causes confrontations. And because they're not dealing with junior ranks, you tend to find that the chief tech will let his feelings be known. And keeping the peace would have been one of my major problems. But it suddenly dawned on me that what the CO was asking me was, can you handle Gordon Adam, the Scottish chief tech? And I said, oh, if you're worried about Gordon, I said, he took over from me at Changi. I am senior to him in both experience and in rank, length in rank. But I said, no, Gordon won't be any problem. And I then took over. But the situation is that I was the only person that worked from 8 till 5. All the rest were on 24 hours on, 24 hours off. And there were three shifts which enabled long weekends to be taken. Every third week you got a really long weekend. And because the Air Force, a lot of the airmen had been encouraged to buy their own houses, through choice there were people that had to come up from Lynham and Bryce Norton to work shifts at Leconfield. Well, it's quite a trek, probably 270 miles to drive home. And so what these lads wanted, they didn't mind how many hours they worked. And a lot of it was sort of sleeping duty. They had to be there ready to go in 2 minutes. They had to get the aircraft airborne.
On call.
But on call, 24 hours a day. Well, they wanted to compress their working time and then to have longer breaks away to save on travelling and making it worthwhile to go all the way back to Lynham. If they could only go on a Friday night and had to be back on Monday lunchtime, it wasn't good for them. So we could arrange that they almost had a week off every fortnight, it worked out as it was. And so with various, we had one of each sort of trade that was required on each shift. And you had to cover independent control checks, which I did most of those, but it was a sort of working out that you had the NCOs to cover the particular task, and because we had so many, it worked out that it was fairly easy to do this, and so the flight ran fairly smoothly. There were one or two people that I wouldn't put together, and with aircraft servicing, where you're supervising, you find the people that aren't quite up to scratch, and so you would always ensure that there was somebody else that was capable of keeping an eye on them, and that you didn't get, say, two wasters on the same shift.
How long did it take you to be able to identify the good ones, separate the sheep from the goats, and work out these?
Oh, it doesn't take very long. I mean, the man's attitude, and because we had to do each time there was a shift, there was usually an inspection to be done, probably a 25-hour or 50-hour inspection. And you can usually tell by the length of time the man takes to do the inspection, the tools he takes to do the inspection with, and quite often the job cards that are raised. I mean, we would probably be aware that there was a problem with the radio, that it wasn't 100%. So because you didn't want to, or you probably hadn't got a spare at the time, you gathered these things in ready for the inspection, and you'd make out all the cards as to what had to be done in addition to the routine maintenance. And there were some quite big tasks that would come up, a gearbox change or an engine change, and it was always nice if you started the shift and you got the work done in time for the new shift take over, that they weren't having to take over half the job from you. And so you soon knew the people that were prepared to graft when it was needed. And it was always our intention to, at the shift changeover, you would be handing over serviceable aircraft. If it was at all possible, you'd hand over a clean crew room, because the men slept at the flight, so the bedroom had to be sort of tidied up and things put right. On occasions, you couldn't avoid having everything in a mess because they'd had so much work. But quite often, the people that lived a long way away, in their off time, they would come in to help the shift that was on if they knew that they were in dire straits.
Yeah. Was there a fairly even pressure of work, or did it go up and down dramatically?
No, it was fairly even, because when you're on standby, it's dawn till dusk. So you would get your aircraft out at dawn, and in winter this was a bigger problem because of ice and snow and stuff, but you'd get your aircraft out, and the pilot would, first thing in the morning, run the aircraft. Now, if it was his first time, he would adjust all the lap straps, he'd leave his helmet and his bone dome in the aircraft, he would know where all the switches were set that needed setting, so that at a moment's notice he could be in that cockpit. Because normally when you got a scramble, you had three aircrew. You'd have the pilot would immediately run to the aircraft, and the ground crew would have him started. So he's doing his pre-flight checks. The winchman would be out there with his equipment and his first aid kit. Now, he'd also changed the aircraft. He knew where there was quite a... In the cabin of the aircraft, there were protective sheets to stop salt water dripping off the survivors through into the gubbins. So it was all drip trays and a sort of plasticky sheeted interior. And there were knives for cutting dinghies and the hooks and things they use. And so When the aircraft was first run in the morning, the winchman would go out there and he'd adjust the harness to suit himself, because they vary in size, and he'd make sure that all his equipment was there. There was morphine, which he had to sign over from the previous crewman each shift change. And so on the scramble bell going, the pilot would go straight to the aircraft, start it up, and he'd wait. The navigator would be on the radio listening to possibly the Coast Guard giving locations and the amount of, if they knew how many people were missing, or if it was an aircraft, what type of aircraft, and last known position and so on. And he would be the last to get to the aircraft, and by the time he was strapped in, it was airborne and gone. And then, of course, you had to call in the second crew. There was a standby crew that had had 24 hours off, so you'd call the CO of the station to let him know that there was a rescue mission on. You'd call the CO of the squadron, and then you would bring in the standby crew, and they would sit in the office. Now, quite often their aircraft was needed as well, so you had the second aircraft there. Usually took a little longer for them to do the checks and get airborne, and quite often these were quite long range trips for the particular aircraft. BP Alpha, which is out in the North Sea there, they quite often had to go out to BP Alpha to pick off injured personnel. And the one during my time, there were one or two very sort of dramatic rescues done, not particularly by Leckenfield, but there was the Amberley rescue from Coltishall, and there was the Seagem, which was done from Leckenfield, but that was before my time at the station. But they were, the crews on those particular missions were in real danger themselves.
What sort of time would they aim for getting off on a scramble?
2 minutes.
2 minutes to be airborne.
Mm. And it was usually worked out fine. The only problems arose if you had a serious defect, an engine failure or something of that ilk, and the other aircraft was in the hangar on an inspection. Then you had to go offline, and this meant that Leckenfield couldn't supply any NERC rescue service, and we were controlled from Petrievi Castle in Scotland. And if you had to ring Petrievi and say, "I'm sorry, Leckenfield's offline," then they would either, depending on the situation, either get an aircraft flown down to Leckenfield to fill in, or Coltishall in the south, to the south of us, and Acklington, or Bulmer as it later became, would have to cover. So it meant that where we would normally operate in the North Sea and up as far as Whitby and down as far as Yarmouth or the South Lincolnshire, and normally we would fly people to Hull General Infirmary or Scarborough Hospital. They would have to come down from Newcastle to do the, and of course it took them longer to get to us. But Petrievi controlled this, and if they thought it warranted it, they'd get an aircraft flown down with a crew to stand by at Leckenfield until we could get our aircraft serviceable again. But this didn't happen during my time there. I went offline twice, once for the aircrew. Had a very bad mission. They'd been coming up the Humber in fog, and they'd hit the water, and they'd pulled up the aircraft to get it out away from the river, and gone up into thick fog, and they didn't have a clue where they were, and they sent out a mayday. They were running short of fuel, and they expected to be diverted to a southern Lincolnshire airfield, Bimbrook or Coningsby or somewhere like that, and they didn't have the fuel to get to where they thought they may be diverted to, and unbeknown to them, they had been given that Leconfield was black. In other words, you'll never get into Leconfield, it's fog-bound, whereas it was only the estuary that was seriously affected. And they actually did get diverted back to their own Leconfield, right. Which was a relief. And I can remember the aircraft coming in and landing, and as he flared prior to landing onto the dispersal, there was water pouring out of the thing, so they'd taken on quite a lot of water when
they dipped into the Humber there.
Yeah, they were lucky to get out of the Humber. They it's a wonder it didn't go in and capsize, you know.
And the other occasion, you said there were two when you had to go offline.
The other occasion, and it came towards the end of my time on the flight, there was a tool lost. And one of the situations is that if you've been working on the aircraft and there's a tool missing, that aircraft can't fly until that tool is found.
Is this because it might have dropped into the mechanism somewhere?
Yeah, well, or been left somewhere where it could
do damage,
jammer control and so on. The particular item was a copper drift. And what used to happen, the shift change used to occur at midday. And one NCO would come in, and the first thing he would check was the main tool board, and all these tools were on little hooks and silhouetted with day glow, so that it was easy to spot anything that was missing. That was the main toolkit. There was also a toolkit in the hangar, which was kept strictly for when there was an inspection. Now, each man had 10 little discs, and as he took a tool, he put one of his discs. They were all coloured, and they were there was a register of the names who had which tags. And so the airman would go in, and if he needed a hammer, he just put his little disc on where the hammer should be, took the hammer. Now, at the end of the shift, the NCO in charge of the retiring shift would go and check the tool board, and he'd say, hang on a minute, John, you've got a hammer out, where is it? And he'd say, oh, it's all right, I've got it in my pocket or whatever. And the board was checked, and the oncoming shift, the NCO in charge would check the tool board and sign. And in the case of inspections, to have to keep coming back to our little sort of headquarters, if you like, where the tool boards were, they had one in the hangar that they used when they were on these inspections. It was permanently locked whenever there was no inspection. But this particular day, I went in and looked at the tool board, and I said to the NCO, there's some tools out. He went and round his troops and said, there was one tool without a tag on it, and it was a copper drift.
What's a drift?
It's a chisel shape, but blunt at the end. And it's, if you've got a bolt through a hole and it's tight, you would get a copper drift because it's nice and soft. Mm. And you would put it on the end of the bolt and tap with a hammer, and it would free the bolt, hopefully,
without,
because it's softer material. If the bolt was really solid, it would just bend the end of the copper drift. Oh. But it's for driving pins or bolts out of holes where they're either locked in through corrosion or they're tight. And so this copper drift was missing, and there was no tag against it. So we got the shift that was about to go off duty at 12 o'clock and said, look, there's a copper drift missing, and it was there yesterday. It's not there now. Now, you don't use a copper drift all that often. One of you must know who's used the copper drift. No. So you go to the air crew, who occasionally had cause to use tools themselves, and because there was no tag on it, have any of you been in the tool room and borrowed a copper drift? No. So the only other, by this time the new shift has come on, and they were on yesterday, they handed over these tools, But just to make sure that the tools were handed over correctly and it wasn't missing yesterday, did any of you use a copper drift? No. So I said, right, well, in that case, the aircraft are grounded, all the panels off, search the aircraft until we find it. I knew in my own mind that it hadn't been used on the aircraft because the servicing was such, we'd been through every job that had been done, and there was very little that would have needed a copper drift because it was all changing batteries and things like that. But you went to every man who'd signed and worked. No. Anyway, it was a man, it was a very senior NCO who had used it on his car. And he'd left it on the... they used to bring the cars up near the flight because they had... once the aircraft were put to bed, all they were doing was sitting watching a television, cooking a meal for themselves, playing cards. Some of them did woodwork. Some of them went to a little gymnasium sort of thing that we had for keeping fit. Others worked on the cars. And he'd been working on his car and he'd left this thing on the wing and driven back to the car park, and it had fallen off in the car park as it turned up a week later. One man produced a copper drift that was very, very, well, it was badly beaten, and he said, I think this is it, and I said, no, that tool wouldn't have been on my board, it would have been changed. So I said, it's a copper drift and that's what we're looking for, but we're looking for one in good condition. That anyway, eventually they satisfied themselves that we'd done all we could, and the aircraft were put back online. But it caused a problem for me, and because of my past record of never having been offline, and it reflected badly on the flight, and because of this, I said, you know, well, I think it's time that you change, you know, that you had a change of chief. So for my last few months, I ended up looking after the engine bay, which I was well qualified to do, and gave somebody else the worry, because it certainly was a worry. You were, although you were 8 till 5, you were there on a lot of evenings and occasions. I used to go into work early, about half an hour early, to sit and just pick up the threads from where they'd been left off the night before, and it did pay off. You know, you often picked up things that had been missed and so on. Because of the constant tensions between the air crew and the ground crew, and the heavy weight, which I pointed out to them, that senior NCOs were allowed an extra 12 days leave a year. I think the airmen got 30 days leave a year, and a senior NCO got 42. Well, because I had 13 chief techs, that was 13 times 12 days extra leave. And I didn't, I sort of didn't want to stop them having it. The fact that he was filling a junior technician's post, who only was entitled to 30 days, this is what the hierarchy tried to make me do, you see. And I said, well, no, you know, a man's, his leave's his leave and he should have it. And I said, to try and work this, the leave in, because ASF will not accept any of the higher ranks to fill more junior posts, and they're more well able to do this leave business. I said, I'm left with this problem. And I said, you know, I think I've done my bit now, and somebody else should have a go at running it, you see. So they let me do it because they thought I didn't need a rest. But
what happened to the chap who'd actually borrowed the tool and lost it?
Well, it all came to light after I had been moved, and he knew who'd done it. I mean, it was found in the car park, and eventually he came to me personally and apologised because he realised it had brought other matters to a head and I'd moved. And of course, the problem in moving was that had I remained where I was, I would have stayed at Leconfield, because Leconfield as an RAF base, apart from the flight, were going to be moved because the Army were taking it over as a school of transport.